So my guest today is Hannah Maslin. Hannah is a postdoctoral research fellow in ethics, working at the Uhiro Centre for Practical Ethics in Oxford, and also affiliated with the Oxford Martin School. And Hannah works in the areas of philosophy of law, specifically in criminal law and punishment, and also in bioethics, particularly on the ethics of human enhancement and mind-machine interventions, which is the reason why I invited her onto the show and why I'm excited to talk to her about some important topics. So yeah, I'd just like to welcome you to the show, Hannah.
Hi, thanks, John.
Okay, so I've said this to every other participant in this so far, but this project is about the way in which technology creates new governance structures and how it creates new governance subjects, and in particular, transhumanist subjects, whatever that might mean. And you know, you write a lot of interesting stuff about neurointerventions and how they impact on certain core political and personal values. And we won't be able to do justice to all of the work you've done today, but I do want to focus on three topics in particular, all arising from the ethics of neurointerventions. The first is autonomy, the second is responsibility, and the third is remorse. And I think those are all important values and topics that it's worth getting into in a bit more detail. So I'll start maybe with a simple question, which is, what is a neurointervention?
Well, I'm not sure that is actually such a simple question. It's quite difficult to come up with a precise definition of neurointerventions that captures everything that we might want to talk about, because in general, we think that neurointerventions are anything that will affect your brain, essentially. And there are a whole host of things that might do that in different ways. So even just going to school or listening to a lecture will affect your brain in certain ways. And that's not really the sort of thing that we're interested in when we focus on neurointerventions. We tend to focus instead on interventions that act directly on the brain. So they would be things like neuroactive pharmaceutical agents. So there's a lot of discussion about cognitive enhancers, for example, drugs that would enhance cognitive capacities, but also even more invasive interventions such as deep brain stimulation, which is a neurosurgical technique that involves inserting electrodes into the brain. There are also less direct ways of stimulating the brain that aren't invasive. There are devices that are being investigated right now and can even be purchased on the internet that involve electrical stimulation, which passes through electrodes that you place on your scalp and modulates neuronal activity, so changes the way that your neurons are responding. And other techniques like transcranial magnetic stimulation, which again is a non-invasive but still direct way of affecting neuronal activity. So there are lots of different examples of neurointerventions, and the sort of common theme in what we're interested in is that they have some sort of direct impact on the brain.
Yeah, and so I suspect, you know, drawing that line between a direct and indirect effect is also maybe a little bit fuzzy and difficult. Does food, if I eat food, does that have a direct impact on the brain, or is that considered to be an indirect impact?
I think that would be more indirect, because the food that you eat obviously goes into your stomach and is digested, and there may be some effect on your brain, or it may contribute to structures in your brain and things like that. But that would be an example of something that would be indirect. The sort of interventions that we have in mind are things where the use of the activity of the intervention is very, very closely related with the effect on the brain. So with brain stimulation, for example, you've got an electrical current generated by a device, and that changes directly the electrical activity in your brain. So you're right that it can be very difficult and to draw a distinction, and to some extent, drugs don't go straight to the brain. But we're concerned with things where it's very clear what the effects are, and where the intended effect of the intervention is to really change something in the brain.
Yeah, so there's a direct neuronal effect, and that's part of the intention behind the use of the device or the drugs or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So you mentioned a few of the technologies there: deep brain stimulation, pharmacological drugs, transcranial direct current stimulation, and transcranial magnetic stimulation, which all have varying degrees of invasiveness associated with them. Are there any other technologies or interventions out there on the horizon that we could think about in terms of this kind of framework of neurointerventions as well?
I think one of the very exciting possibilities that is very much in the future, but is still getting quite a lot of attention in research communities, is optogenetics, which would involve actually modifying neurons so that they respond to light, so that you can turn individual neurons on and off, as it were. At the moment, it's quite uncertain precisely what this could be used for, but it's thought there could be a lot of clinical applications. And so far, the sort of experiments that have been done have mostly been on mice, and there was one experiment where they did this in the mouse's motor cortex, and when they stimulated those neurons, that the mouse just runs left in a circle, and it's quite a striking thing to look. You can look up videos of this, but it just goes to show how precise we might get one day with our ability to intervene in the brain.
Yeah, and hopefully I'll find one of those videos and include it in the show notes here. So, I mean, the optogenetics would give us a much more kind of selective pinpoint effect on neuronal processes. Would it be fair to say that at the moment the kinds of technologies we have are a little bit cruder in terms of their effect, a little bit less directed?
Yeah, that's right. So it depends. It differs between the different interventions. Things like TDCS, so this transcranial direct current electrical stimulation, has pretty poor spatial resolution. So the intention is to try to target a certain area of the brain. It might be the language area, if you're wanting to have some effect on verbal fluency, for example. But it's going to be quite imprecise in the way that it actually affects the brain. Something like deep brain stimulation is more precise because you're putting the electrodes right into the brain. But again, it's not down to the level of the single neuron.
Okay, so I think that's a useful definition and set of examples as well. As you say, there are kind of fuzzy boundaries and category distinctions to draw here, but I still think those examples will help to give this idea of a neural intervention a more kind of concrete framework in people's minds. The questions I'm interested in really are how these neural interventions impact upon kind of core values, in particular political values. And as I said, I wanted to zone in on a few of them, autonomy being the first. Now, you've written one paper that deals with this quite directly, which has to do with the role of deep brain stimulation in the treatment of people with anorexia nervosa. Now, this happens to be a topic, actually, that I spoke about a couple of weeks ago with Sven Nyholm. He gave some sense of the ways in which this could be used to treat people and how it might have impacts on personal identity. I want to take a bit of a longer discussion on that today. And let me start with an initial question, which is when it comes to the use of neurointerventions to alter somebody's personality, their desires, or for treatment purposes, is there some reason why we should object to them just in general? Is there kind of a prima facie objection to the use of these direct neuronal interventions as opposed to the more traditional indirect neuronal interventions?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's a sort of prima facie objection to them. I think that it's going to depend whether they are ethically permissible and whether they're desirable and so on. It's going to depend very much on what they do, what their mechanisms are, what we're using them for, how the individual who is having their brain intervened on relates to that intervention. So whether it's sort of actively sought out or whether it's merely accepted, or it's unlikely we would be without concern if it was non-consensual. But within the range of consensual neurointerventions, I don't think there's an in-principle objection to them, no.
Yeah, but, I mean, some people have then tried to identify distinctions between the classic indirect methods, let's say like education for enhancing cognitive potential, versus a direct intervention like the use of some drug like modafinil. I'm thinking in particular of Marcia Shermer and Farah Folkert's distinction between the idea that some of them have a treat you passively and some of them treat you actively. Could you maybe talk about that distinction?
Yeah, sure. So this relates to the idea as well of whether the intervention is cognitively mediated or rationally mediated. This links up with the idea of whether the agent is passive or active with respect to that intervention. The idea with education is that it doesn't bypass your rational capacities. You respond to reasons to change your mind about things, for example. And so that this is a very active way of engaging engaging with that intervention. Something like modafinil, supposedly you're passive with respect to that effect. You don't have any kind of insight into how it's working. It just has that effect on you. And any changes that which are thereby produced are not sort of a result of you having engaged in some sort of rational deliberation. I think that there's a sort of broader way we can think about the use of these interventions, though. I mean, I can think about what modafinil does. I can try to understand how it's likely to affect me. I can think about the purposes I might want to use it for. And I can make a decision to use it. And I can be quite active in making that decision and in thinking about the way it is affecting me, at least from the point of view of my experience of it. So although I think it is helpful to think about active and passive engagements or lack of engagements with technologies, I don't think that at the point of the intervention, this is the only possibility for active engagement.
Yeah, so I mean, if somebody's tipping modafinil into the water supply, to give a classic dystopian example, that would clearly treat you passively. You're a passive victim almost of the neurointervention. But if you rationally reflect upon the use of modafinil and think about its various costs and benefits and the potential mechanisms of action, you've turned something that might appear to be a passive intervention into something that you're actually quite actively engaged with.
Sure. And the same can be true for indirect interventions. So if you think about subliminal advertising, for example, or perhaps advertising more generally, that's not directly affecting your brain in the sense that we've talked about with the interventions like pharmaceuticals, but you may not be sort of rationally engaging with it. So there may be a sense in which you're passive with respect to that indirect intervention.
Sure. Okay. So, I mean, I'm sympathetic to that line of thought, but I think it's useful to spell out that argument there. Deep brain stimulation is going to be a direct intervention. You're putting electrodes to target various parts of somebody's brain. How could this be used to treat patients with anorexia nervosa then?
Well, this is a very new area of clinical research, and it's complicated by the fact that neuroscientists and psychiatrists disagree amongst themselves about what's really sort of gone wrong in anorexia nervosa. I mean, in general, it's anorexia nervosa is characterized by compulsive starvation and other weight loss behaviors that often lead to severe malnutrition and in some cases death. But what's really sort of going on in the brain of the anorexic patient, in the psychology of the anorexic patient, is quite a place of discussion and disagreement. But there are a number of neuroscientists who think that deep brain stimulation could be used to treat it. But the disagreements about what's gone wrong also reflect disagreements about how deep brain stimulation could be used. So the idea is that there might be particular areas of the brain that are implicated in the symptoms of anorexia that, if stimulated, could change their activity such that the symptoms are alleviated or disappear. And there are at least three different target areas, so three different parts of the brain that have been suggested by neuroscientists as potential targets for deep brain stimulation.
Okay, and so maybe you could outline what those potential targets might be.
Sure. So one of those targets is the nucleus accumbens, which is implicated in reward processing. So the idea here is that if you were to stimulate the nucleus accumbens, you might be able to fix some aberrant reward processing in relation to food in particular, but also more generally. The reward processing of the anorexic patient is thought to be quite out of kilter, kind of more across the board. And in a very sort of general way, the idea is that you could increase the patient's wanting and liking of food, wanting of food and liking of food, such that he or she then engages in eating more. The other area of the brain that's been considered is part of the prefrontal cortex, which is to do with sort of top-down executive control. And the idea here is that part of what's gone wrong in anorexia is an over-habituation of these weight loss behaviors, such that they become essentially compulsive. The patient can't resist them, even if she or he would want to do so. So in stimulating part of the prefrontal cortex, the idea is that the patient may be able to achieve greater control, again, over these weight loss behaviors. And the third area is in the part of the emotional part of the brain. So the idea here is that a significant part of what anorexia involves is actually affective dysregulation, so that something's gone wrong in emotional processing. Anorexia is often comorbid with anxiety and depression. And if anxiety and depression can be alleviated, then patients will be able to participate and engage with engage with traditional methods such as talking therapies and things like that. So there's a sort of indirect effect there where alleviating emotional symptoms can help them engage with other treatment methods that may help them overcome their anorexia.
Yeah, so you kind of clear the problematic affective response, and that opens up the pathway to the more traditional methods. So, I mean, within that framework you've outlined there, anorexia nervosa is characterized by this compulsive starvation. It's also linked to a certain set of values that the patient appears to espouse or ascribe to, particularly around body image and the desire to be thin. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, definitely. Most anorexic patients report that either they started off or even indeed continue to value thinness very highly, such that they would pursue it almost at any cost. Or it might be a little bit more nuanced than that, that they dislike the idea of being big. They might believe that they are still big, and body dysmorphia is obviously also comorbid with anorexia. So, but there does seem to be this very clear goal of the anorexic patient, especially in sort of the early stages, that being thin is the thing that matters most.
Yeah, so that might be what initially motivates them, but then it becomes a compulsive disorder over time. And then there are these three possible mechanisms of resolving it through DBS, at least. One is to modify their reward signaling. One is to improve their cognitive control, their ability to control their compulsive desires. And then the third one is to change their affective regulation, their response to or how they feel about food, I guess.
That's right. And of course, it differs from patient to patient whether this evaluation of thinness and this goal to be thin, it persists into later stages of the illness. Some anorexic patients actually want to get better, but as you say, the weight loss behaviors have become so compulsive and there's such anxiety associated with eating that they can't overcome that. But other patients still maintain that they value thinness so much that even when they're faced with the realities of their malnutrition, their evaluation of thinness doesn't seem to change.
Okay, so if we did use DBS to treat patients with anorexia nervosa, I'm assuming they would be signing some kind of informed consent form to allow the treatment. But there's still in the background maybe a scary notion that if we use a neurointervention, we're somehow changing them, in particular if we're using it to change what they desire, how they value and approach food, let's say. I guess the question I want to ask here is, first of all, is it possible to alter somebody's desires through the use of DBS? And would this undermine their autonomy in some respect?
Yeah, so I think there's an initial question about how autonomous the anorexic patient is with respect particularly to decision making that relates to treatment for the illness and to eating as well. And so the autonomy of an anorexic patient is quite a difficult thing to get a handle on to start with. And so how sort of changing desires might interact with that is going to be quite complicated. But the idea, as I was saying, with deep brain stimulation, particularly of the nucleus accumbens, is that the stimulation could increase the patient's explicit wanting and liking of food, such that she's more inclined and perhaps will also enjoy to engage in eating and then put on weight and then not be in such great danger. So the idea is that this wanting and liking of food could be put back on track, that the aberrant reward processing could be fixed so that the anorexic patient can engage again in eating.
So you've mentioned this wanting, liking distinction a couple of times, and I know that has a particular meaning when it comes to the neuroscience of desire, I guess. So perhaps you could maybe explain what that distinction is.
Yeah, sure. So it might seem a bit strange to even make this distinction, because normally wanting and liking go hand in hand. So we tend to want things that we like, and we tend to like things that we want and be disposed to pursue things that we like. So normally these go together, and we might think sort of desire captures both of those. But in the anorexic patient, it's thought, at least by some neuroscientists, that what goes wrong involves these two things becoming out of sync. So wanting relates to the motivational drive to pursue something, so being disposed to pursue something, whereas liking refers to the sort of finding it rewarding, finding it sort of hedonically pleasurable. And in anorexic patients, it's thought that this has sort of gone awry, so that patients might want food but not like it, and that the deep brain stimulation could in part correct this aberrant processing.
Okay, and does the wanting-liking distinction apply to other kinds of compulsive behavior, like the behavior of addicts as well? Is that something that arises?
So I think there's an interesting comparison here with people who are addicted to certain substances. So, for example, alcoholics, who may continue to want alcohol in the sense that they're motivated to drink it, that they find themselves sort of drawn to it, but they no longer find it rewarding. And so this sort of shows another example where wanting and liking cease to work in concert.
Yeah, okay. And there's another distinction as well that you mentioned, or he didn't mention it explicitly as it happens, but it's this idea that some cognitive functions are explicit and then some are implicit. And you talked about altering explicit wanting behavior. So what is that explicit-implicit distinction? How does it apply here?
Yeah, the idea is that, especially with wanting, it can be the case that an individual can want something implicitly, but perhaps not explicitly. And what this means is that although they are sort of driven to pursue whatever that thing is, this may not be accessible to their conscious awareness. So they may not sort of feel the pull of the thing that towards which they're motivated, but nonetheless be disposed to act. And this is sort of illustrated by an example of a study where anorexic patients were asked to respond to certain stimuli, and they were asked to report how much they are motivated towards the thing, and they reported no motivation, but their reaction times suggested, at least to the neuroscientists interpreting the data, that there was an implicit motivation going on underneath. So this sort of raises interesting questions. If you phrase the anorexic's processing in such a way that they implicitly want food still, but don't explicitly want it and don't explicitly like it, then there's a sense in which they're still motivated towards it that's not accessible to their conscious awareness.
Yeah, so I mean, this then seems interesting to me in terms of how the use of DBS might impact on autonomy, or the relationship between a neural intervention and somebody's autonomy, because there are certain classic theories of autonomy, what are generally referred to as higher order theories of autonomy, where it's about you're autonomous if your higher order preferences, your lower order preferences are consistent with your higher order preferences, where higher order is usually associated with this kind of explicit rational reflection. So applying that to the example there, you might say implicitly the lower order preferences of the anorexic is still to want food. They still have that motivation, but their higher order explicit processing seems to not want the food.
Yeah, but I wonder if this is captures everything that's going on here. I think that explicit and implicit wanting, when discussed in this neurological literature, are both at this first order level. Mm. So you're disposed to want food, and if you explicitly want food, you also feel the pull of it. But that still doesn't quite get us yet to the level where you're happy that you're feeling the pull of it because you want to feel you want to. you want to allow it to pull you towards the object of that motivation. So I think that there's a danger here where those who might suggest that this sort of intervention might actually be good for a patient's autonomy, perhaps in the way that it makes an implicit motivation explicit, and therefore sort of brings those back in line, reveals to the patient that actually, you know, she did want this all along, and so now, you know, can be autonomous in pursuing it after the intervention. This still misses this second order level where we can be really unhappy that we have certain explicit motivations.
Yeah, and that might be particularly problematic in the case of the patient who still expresses this strong preference for thinness, or has a strong kind of value of maintaining a certain body image. Is that fair? So like you're rendering explicit their implicit wanting for food, but that is still inconsistent with this deeper value commitment that they happen to have.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. And actually, some of the neurosurgeons who carried out one of these studies in China did express this worry that a patient might end up in a psychological hell if they now felt themselves consciously and and it being the case that they were unconsciously drawn to food, but nonetheless didn't want to be drawn to food because they continued to value thinness so highly, that this could be even worse, because then they're having to fight against this now explicit motivation.
Yeah, so it renders it explicit, a kind of psychological anguish which previously was resting below the level of conscious awareness.
Okay,
so we've danced around issues to do with autonomy and DBS and the treatment of anorexia nervosa, but let me just put this question to you. What method of treating anorexia nervosa through the use of DBS, in your view, would be most consistent with respecting the patient's autonomy?
To the extent that one of the significant features of anorexia is that weight loss behavior has become compulsive in a way that the patient can't control, I think the way that we could intervene that is most consistent with autonomy and would promote autonomy would be the method that would increase the patient's cognitive control over their behaviors. Because on sort of any theory of autonomy, having greater control over what you do, over your behavior, is going to be a good thing. And so even if the patient were to decide that actually these compulsive behaviors, the habituated weight loss, helps them in their pursuit of thinness, and they still want to pursue thinness, increasing control doesn't prevent them from doing this. It gives them greater resources if they were to choose to do this. So I think that if it really is the case that interventions into the prefrontal cortex could increase cognitive control in this way, then this has got to be good on any account of autonomy.
Yeah, so anything that enhances this cognitive control is more consistent anyway with respecting autonomy, whereas, let's say, playing around with motivations and wanting and liking is maybe a little bit more iffy from the perspective of autonomy. Would that be...
Yeah, I would say so.
So let me just finish up this conversation about anorexia nervosa and DBS with another question, which widens the scope a little bit. To me, what's interesting about this case study is how it highlights the way in which society approaches the personal values of people and how that intersects with respect for autonomy. So I think a lot of people find the desires, let's say, of a patient with anorexia nervosa troubling, that we don't think it falls within the range of acceptable preferences to want to be chronically thin. And perhaps this highlights a problem with value pluralism, that what kind of values should we respect? Does the desire for extreme thinness fall within the range of acceptable desires? Now, this is a topic that I talked about a couple of weeks ago with Sven Nyholm, but I wanted to ask you a slightly different variation on the question that I asked him, which is, do you think the availability of neurointerventions will heighten problems around value pluralism, this kind of clash of what's an acceptable personal value, insofar as the more we can play around with our brains, the more we can realize certain desires or preferences that perhaps previously we weren't able to realize?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. And I think it's also going to depend on the sort of purposes that are presented alongside neurointervention technology. So on the one hand, we might think that neurointerventions are great because people can will be able to, for example, use TDCS to enhance whatever capacity it is that they think is going to be of value to them, whether it's working memory, whether it's creativity, or any of the other possibilities that are at least thought within the realms of possible applications of brain stimulation. And so to that extent, you know, people can pursue their different conceptions of what is good for them. But I think a lot of neurointerventions are sold or offered or created with the idea that they would be used for a particular purpose. And so, for example, deep brain stimulation is being developed to fix problems, as it were. So the intervention that is offered to the patient with anorexia or the patient with chronic pain, for example, is offered in the context of this neurointervention will fix a problem. And the same might be true with some drugs as well, with many drugs. And so I think that the way in which we could use neurointerventions outside of this sort of social context, the possibilities are great for being able to pursue our different ideas of what's going to be good for us and for our lives. But the way in which they are offered in society, and the way in which they are thought to be used well in society, is going to come with certain assumptions about what we should be doing with our brains and what we should be trying to pursue, and perhaps which enhancements are good and which conditions we need to try and fix. So I think there's going to be some real tricky issues for individual freedom, essentially.
Yeah, I think that's important insofar as there's an ideology and a set of assumptions behind the promotion and marketing of these technologies as well. So yeah, let's switch topics here to focus on how technology can be used to build better citizens. This is something that came up in a previous conversation I had with the transhumanist James Hughes, who's a fan of the idea of using technology to build better citizens, though in a way that is consistent with their autonomy and consent. Now, one way that we could use technology to build better citizens is by making them more responsible, because there's a common sense that responsibility is an important social value and a virtue. And I guess there are two ways in which this arises. One is in criminal and legal contexts, where we look to find the agent that is responsible for some wrongdoing, and it's deemed to be a good thing if we can find the responsible wrongdoer. And there's also this broader sense of responsibility as being a virtue, that the responsible citizen is one who can take control over more aspects of their lives and takes their duties towards others seriously. And this is often tied in as well to various ideologies. So people who talk about neoliberalism a lot and worry about the responsabilization of citizens. But anyway, let me ask you an initial question. Can we use technology to enhance people's responsibility?
There are some people who have argued that we could enhance capacities that will then have will have implications for responsibility in a couple of senses. So if we were able to use drugs, for example, to enhance people's cognitive capacities, this might mean that firstly, that some individuals, perhaps professionals with very high risk jobs like surgeons or pilots, firstly, that they might have a responsibility to enhance their capacities if they were, for example, able to reduce their levels of fatigue or increase their levels of concentration. And then there are potentially secondary implications for responsibility, in the sense that once you're enhanced, perhaps you become more responsible for failures when enhanced, because you have this greater capacity. So we might hold you more blameworthy for failing to perform well. And these are very contentious questions, but they've certainly been considered.
Yeah, and I think one of the main examples that's discussed in the literature, and I know this is one that you've discussed in some of your work, is the surgeon and fatigue for surgeons. So if you're going through some very complex surgical procedure that lasts a number of hours and you didn't get much sleep because you're on call, this might impact upon your performance. And then there are certain drugs that you could take maybe that would improve your liveliness or your awareness, overcome those effects of fatigue. And that would be a kind of enhancement. And maybe there should even be a duty upon surgeons to take these drugs to avoid the problems associated with fatigue.
Yeah, so this is what's being considered. And of course, there are separate questions about whether there might be a moral duty. So whether morality might require you to take these drugs, and then whether there might be a legal duty, which means that the state could enforce your taking of those drugs in certain situations, either through punishment if you didn't take them or some sort of civil liability.
Yeah, so what's your feeling on those two issues, so the moral aspect and the legal aspect? Do you think there should be this moral duty, and do you think it's likely that this will become a legal duty?
I think it depends very much on the features of the drug in question, on quite what your role is, so on and so forth, when it comes to the moral question. I think and this is a very stylized example, but it's one that's types used, if there was a drug that was completely safe and effective and in reducing fatigue, for example, and you're a pilot and it's likely you're going to get fatigued on this long haul flight, and the risks that fatigue presents are high enough, then I think there might be a sort of duty of easy rescue for you to take that drug. So from the moral point of view, it would depend on really how easy it was for you to bear that burden of having to take the drug, and on what the size of the benefits that could thereby be produced. But when it comes to law, I don't think that it's going to be likely that there will ever be a legal duty for surgeons or pilots, for example, to enhance themselves. A legal duty could come about through the mechanisms of civil law, so that someone could sue you essentially for not having taken an enhancer where they think that your failure to take it has caused them some harm. I don't think that the law would ever see a claim like this as something that could be successful because of the realities of the way in which these drugs work, the way in which they affect people differently, and so on. So, for example, modafinil comes with a lot of different side effects. It causes gastrointestinal upset, for example, which is something that could create more risks in a particular instance of surgery. It works better for some people than for others. And the law requires us to be able to say, if it is the case that someone is going to be liable for failing to take an enhancer, it has to be the case that the responsible surgeon would have taken the pill. But there's no sort of medicinal profile of the responsible surgeon. And given that in some cases it might help, but in other cases it might not, because of the particular theological characteristics of that journal and the way in which the drug works or doesn't work with them, I don't think that it's ever going to be the case that we could say that the responsible surgeon would have taken the pill, and therefore the surgeon's failure to do so is one that's going to be the basis of a successful lawsuit.
Yeah, the failure would not be legally blameworthy given the realities of the side effects and issues associated with drugs of this sort, or other potential neurointerventions of this sort.
Yeah, and because we can't say to a high enough degree of probability that taking the drug would have prevented whatever the harm was thought to be from that resulted from the failure in taking the drug.
Yeah. So let me ask another more general questions about this idea of responsibility enhancement. So I'm aware of a lot of people who are critical of the idea of over-responsabilization of citizens in or professionals as well, because they think that, you know, if you look at welfare programs, there's a lot of tendency to blame the poor, that they haven't taken enough responsibility for their own well-being and getting a job. They need a bit more get up and go. And this is deemed problematic by various schools of thought because it ignores the tremendous role of luck and social circumstance and social disadvantage in their lives, and how the barriers imposed by society prevent them really from having a bit more get up and go and becoming getting a job. And so is there a danger if we emphasize the use of technology to enhance responsibility that we add to this problem of over-responsabilization?
So I don't think that the availability of enhancements per se is going to create a problem of over-responsibility. radicalization. I think it's going to depend how we react to and engage with individuals who may or may not choose to use enhancements. So just the availability of modafinil, for example, let's say it does work in a number of cases for surgeons to reduce their fatigue and help them perform better, then this alone isn't going to, I don't think, put pressure on them to perform more highly than they would have otherwise, and nor necessarily are we going to hold them responsible for choosing to take enhancers or not. And so I think it's going to really depend on how employment law and tort law generally reacts to the possibilities that enhancements are supposedly going to present for performing at a higher standard. I mean, when it comes to thinking about what our moral obligations are, our moral duties, we tend to think that there's a certain sort of threshold over which it'll be good if we do things and we'd be praiseworthy, but they'd be supererogatory, so that although they would be morally praiseworthy, we don't feel like people have failed morally if they don't do these things. And I think that it's going to be important for policymakers and lawmakers to keep this sort of idea in mind, that perfection, failure to be perfect, isn't necessarily blameworthy. And this is going to have to, obviously, there's going to be have to be a discussion about what the standard of care required is in different professions, for example, and different jobs, what sort of duties you need to fulfill is in sort of professional duties, but try to demarcate a landscape above which individuals might use enhancements or might try to perform above that level, but really try to protect them from being de facto or even legally required to do so.
Yeah, so I mean, in a sense, then it becomes a question of what the broader political forces and ideologies shaping the legal framework within which the technologies become available. That's the critical question there.
Yes, I think so.
Let me then ask one final question about responsibility. Isn't a lot of this discussion just moot about having more responsibility and enhancements for surgeons and pilots, since we're just going to get robot surgeons and robot pilots to do all the dangerous work anyway, and they're going to be safer and more effective than any human could ever be?
Well, that's an interesting question. But in a sense, we do already have robot pilots. They're called autopilots. Mm-hmm. But we nonetheless think that it's important to have a human pilot right at the end of the chain of responsibility, just in case things go wrong. And it is going to be interesting to see how we start thinking about the extent to which we should trust robots and other machines to do things so well, such that we wouldn't think we need a human being there just in case things go wrong. So I think that there's going to be ways in which we can use robots and use machines to help us do jobs better. I mean, it's better that we have autopilot, for example, on planes than not, of course, but there might always be the need for a human being just in case technology fails. And in a sense, it's the same reason we have two pilots rather than just one, in case that the human being fails. And so the questions of responsibility are not going to completely go away if we've got a human being remaining right at the end of the responsibility chain.
Yeah, and then this is actually a live debate as well, particularly in relation to, let's say, autonomous weapon systems, where people worry, in fact, about responsibility gaps. And there's definitely a bit of a drive to ensure that humans are still included in the loop, so that we do have some responsible human being to whom it's all linked back. All right. So continuing on the theme of building better citizens through technology, we've talked about responsibility. Now let's talk about another interesting topic that you've explored in your work, which is remorse. And remorse seems to play an important role in the criminal justice system, particularly in relation to the mitigation of sentences at a trial. And you've also looked at the ways in which we could enhance remorse through neurointerventions. So let's try and explore this topic a little bit as well. Let me start with an initial question, which I know has a complex answer, but I want to ask it anyway, which is, what is remorse?
So remorse is usually thought to be a sort of an emotion. But once we try to think about what comprises that emotion, it turns out that it's actually got at least three elements or so I think. There's a cognitive element, which relates to the beliefs that are involved in remorse. So we could specify these very precisely, but at a broad level, the person who feels remorse is going to believe that they did something that affected another agent, usually causing them harm, for example, and also have beliefs about their blameworthiness for having caused that harm. And it's going to include the affective dimensions, so the emotional dimensions, the aversive feeling that's involved. So remorse comes from the Latin remordere, which is the sort of rebiting, the gnawing effect of remorse, which is probably what we think of first when we think about remorse. So this is going to involve sort of sorrow for the situation, compassion for the victim, and possibly self-loathing or self-hatred as well. And then finally, remorse involves a motivational dimension. It involves motivations, for example, not to carry out the same sort of act again, so not to do the thing again. It would be quite strange if somebody claimed to be remorseful but then was indifferent to whether they would do it again or not. And also motivations associated with apologizing and providing reparation where possible.
So if we worked with a concrete example here, let's say that I ran over my neighbor's dog, it would be a terrible thing to happen. I wouldn't like for that to happen. So if I were to experience genuine remorse, I would have to have a set of beliefs. So I'd have to believe that I did the action and that this had some effect on an identifiable agent. Now, you could argue that the animal itself is the identifiable agent, but I won't get into that. So it's my neighbor in this case that's the identifiable agent. And then I believe that I have wronged them and that I am blameworthy for that wrong. So that's the cognitive element of remorse. Then the affective side of things is that I feel deep sorrow and perhaps even self-loathing or self-hatred for what I've done, and I am sympathetic towards them as the victim of my wrongdoing. And then finally, the motivational element is that I wish to atone for what I've done, to apologize. I think it would be a little bit crass to suggest that I'd buy them another pet, since I think the pet would be irreplaceable, but I certainly want to apologize and atone for what I've done. And I also clearly want to have the intention not to do anything like that ever again, although that intention may be unsuccessful. I think you point that out in some of your work, that it doesn't have to be the case that you never actually do it again. You just have to have the genuine intention not to do it again.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, we're familiar with the problem of weakness of will. But if you intend not to do the thing again and then end up somehow doing it against your best attempts to stop yourself from doing it again, we might think that this puts the genuineness of your original remorse in question, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you weren't remorseful before. We can mess up again, even when we really feel like we did wrong the first time.
Yeah, because we are imperfect agents and our responsibility and weakness of the will, it hasn't been perfectly tweaked through technology yet. We can fail in the future.
Yeah.
Why does remorse mitigate sentences? And actually, let me divide this into two questions. Is it the case that it really does have a powerful impact on mitigation in criminal sentences, that the defendant who shows remorse is less likely to get a punitive sentence? Is that the case?
It is certainly the case in a number of jurisdictions. So when the offender is sentenced by the sentencing judge, one of the things that the judge is often directed to take into account is whether or not the offender is remorseful. And if the offender is remorseful, this is often taken to be a mitigating factor. So the severity of the sentence will be reduced to some extent. It's not huge. It certainly doesn't mean that you aren't going to receive punishment, but that it's seen to justify a reduction, some reduction in the offender's sentence. And this is the case in England and Wales. It's the case in the US, the case in Australia, and many other jurisdictions.
And why is that the case? Why should it be the case that remorse justifies reducing sentences?
Well, this is a much more contentious question. So the fact that it is current practice doesn't necessarily mean that it should be. Sure. And working out whether it should be is quite difficult. So there are two ways we might at least start to try to answer that question. The first would be to come from a consequentialist perspective on punishment. So very briefly, consequentialists think that the institution of punishment is justified because of the good consequences that arise. So principally reduction of crime and protection of people in society. And so the question for the consequentialist would be whether remorse either reduces the need for deterrence, so makes the offender kind of more easily deterred, or perhaps whether it's sort of indicative of rehabilitation that's already occurred in the offender, such that the sentence just doesn't need to be as severe to achieve the crime preventing outcome. And this is, of course, an empirical question, whether or not remorse is really associated with a decrease in reoffending.
Yeah, but you can make the prima facie case that it seems plausible that it might do.
Yes. From a retributive point of view, retributivists think that the institution of punishment is justified simply because the offender deserves to be punished for what they've done. And the punishment should be proportioned to the seriousness of that offence, so which is going to be a function of its harm and the harm and culpability, harm of the offence and the culpability of the offender for causing that harm or risking that harm in some cases. And that punishment is then proportioned. The offender gets their just deserts, as it were. So the question here is actually, it seems, more difficult because retributivism is backwards looking. It asks, what does the offender deserve given what they did? And since remorse happens after the fact, it doesn't seem to change the seriousness of the offence. It doesn't change the harm that was caused. It doesn't change what the offender's mental states were at the time of the offence. So for the retributivist, this might be seen as quite a difficult thing to justify. But I think that there are ways in which some of the modern desert theories that are based on the idea that punishment communicates deserved censure to the offender, that these theories can find a role for remorse, given its moral value. So given the moral understanding that it demonstrates in the offender, that if what punishment is meant to do is to censure the offender, to bring their minds to understand, direct them to understand the wrongfulness of what they've done, then remorse in some ways preempts this. And so the censure that's required is thereby reduced.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing that a lot of retributivist theorists suggest, at least in my casual reading of the literature, is that one advantage that retributivism has over consequentialism is that it has greater respect for the agency and dignity of the offender. Whereas, you know, consequentialist theories treat offenders as instruments to desirable ends, doesn't respect their agency. So in a sense, you could argue that giving some weight to remorse in mitigating sentences is part of that greater respect for the agency of the defendant, because they've shown that they've come to appreciate the moral wrongness of what they've done. So they've used their own moral agency to come to a conclusion that we want them to reach anyway.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so then the next question is, can we use neurointerventions to actually enhance remorse? And actually, there's an interesting example in one of your papers, which is worth throwing in here, about the amnesic driver. Maybe you could outline that example.
Yeah, so this is actually what inspired the paper in the first place. There was a case in Poland of Maciej Ziantowski, who was basically Poland's kind of answer to Jeremy Clarkson, or I guess it's Chris Evans now. It was their version of Top Gear. And so he was a journalist, but also a driver. He was very good at driving. And he'd borrowed a car and had with him a friend in the passenger seat. And he was driving very recklessly. There's sort of camera evidence to prove that this was the case. And he crashed the car and killed his friend, or his friend was killed as a result. And Maciej Ziantowski ended up in a coma. But when he came out of the coma, he was told about what had happened. He hadn't any memory of it. So he'd suffered amnesia with respect to that particular event and also a little bit surrounding that time in his life. And so when he finally went to trial, it was very interesting because at least part of what the prosecution were saying in the sentencing hearing was, well, he doesn't feel remorse. And at some other point in an interview, Ziantowski had said, I know what I did was, I know what I did. I know that I did it. And I want to feel remorse. In fact, he said that he had, but that he couldn't, he was unable to feel remorse. And he said that he had three pictures above his bed that he would look at every night. He had a picture of his friend before the crash. He had a picture of the car that was involved in the crash, and that he had a picture of his friend's grave. And he would reflect on these because he really wanted to feel remorse, but he couldn't. And so we started to think about this as an interesting case study where remorse had been seen to be relevant, at least by the prosecutor. But there was this problem where the individual wanted to feel remorse, but couldn't.
And so what was he lacking in that case? If you, we had the three elements of remorse earlier on. He knew that he did something, and he seems to have appreciated that it was wrong, and he wanted to feel remorse. So what was absent in his case?
So here he didn't have autobiographical memory of the event itself. So he held the belief that the event occurred because of the testimony of other people. And he fully believed that it did occur. He could see the footage as well. But he didn't have that access to his mental states and his experience at the time of the crash. So he had no insight into whether he had thought about driving too fast, whether he'd thought about it but decided, you know, this is too fun. Or so that sort of access to the sorts of things that are usually thought relevant for the mental element of the offence, the mens rea, that the bit that really determines how culpable, how blameworthy the offender is, he had no access to that in his memory. So he wasn't really able to kind of enter into that, the memory of the event, enough for it to produce this, the affective element, so this aversive affect, that the feelings that are associated with remorse.
And so is there potential of having some neural intervention that could generate those autobiographical memories? Could we have some memory enhancement that gives him what he needs to experience remorse?
Well, at the moment, there's nothing that very clearly would do that sort of thing. And actually, he is that there are various ways in which people can be amnesic. And if they've suffered damage to the brain, it might be more difficult than in cases where individuals have what's called dissociative amnesia, which is psychologically induced, where there have been a whole range of potential interventions from sort of hypnosis and other therapies like that, through to potential drugs. TDCS, for example, is also being considered in this area as well. It seems to be considered for almost anything at the moment, but those sorts of possibilities are certainly on the table for individuals who are experiencing dissociative amnesia, to reconnect them to their autobiographical memories of the events in question.
So this would help us to kind of intervene with the cognitive element of remorse, to enhance remorse by giving the person the beliefs that they need to generate the appropriate affect and motivations. Are there other technologies potentially on the horizon that could tweak the other elements of remorse?
So I think that there's a really interesting area to think about relating to empathy. Now, when I say empathy, I don't just mean the aversive affect. Empathy is perhaps a tool, a means to achieving that aversive effect. And there are two main ways in which we can think about empathy. There's a cognitive dimension to empathy, and also an affective dimension to empathy. So cognitive empathy is more or less synonymous with theory of mind. So the ability to appreciate the mental states of others, that others do have mental states, and what those mental states are likely to be, their nature and so on. And so theory of mind is what is thought to be missing in many people with autism and Asperger's, for example, that they just wouldn't be able to understand that someone else was suffering, for example, as a result of what they've done. I mean, small children have a problem with this as well. And the sort of what it really means for someone else to be suffering. And so if there were interventions that were able to help with the cognitive dimension of empathy, that would essentially, again, help with the cognitive element of remorse. So it would give those people access to would help them come to the belief that they had harmed someone else, and what it really meant to have harmed someone else. Another dimension of empathy, of course, is the affective component, which sort of pertains to the extent to which the agent experiences an emotional response to the other person's situation. So this is... we've described it as a sort of perceptual capacity to be able to really sort of appreciate the moral significance of the suffering of others, and that this often results in compassion or remorse when one is the cause of that suffering, but doesn't necessarily result in that affective dimension. So it's important to note here that if there were an intervention that could increase affective empathy, this doesn't just mean that we make the person feel bad. It might give them the sort of moral perceptual apparatus to appreciate the moral facts that on the basis of which they should feel bad.
Yeah, but I think people would be suspicious about the idea of neural interventions to enhance remorse, insofar as there seem to be something morally imperfect or not quite as valuable about a directed remorse. And I think you have the example in one of your papers, a thought experiment. Imagine if somebody had a remorse pill, that they could just take this pill and suddenly feel remorseful. Would that have the same kind of weight to it as traditional examples of somebody feeling remorse? Would we be inclined to mitigate a sentence as much if we had remorse that was induced through a neurointervention versus remorse induced through an unknown causal pathway?
I think this is it's very important to be careful about what we're talking about here. I think if remorse was indeed induced, so if and again this is fantastical, but if you could give someone a pill and they just felt the kind of the gnawing of remorse, the bad feeling, then no, of course this isn't going to be morally valuable. It's probably not going to be of any penal significance, or shouldn't be anyway. And I think the reason why this is so is because that kind of bad feeling that the pill induces is not connected in the right way to beliefs about having done wrong, and beliefs about one's blameworthiness, for the harm caused. And so if we think about remorse as just being induced, imposed, then no, I don't think that's going to have any moral value. But the sort of mechanisms that we were at least considering as a sort of thought experiments, and I should emphasize they really were thought experiments, which I think then had the consequence of helping us understand what is of moral value in remorse. These sorts of mechanisms were, we characterized them as facilitating remorse rather than inducing remorse. So the idea is that it gives the agent everything that they need for them to feel remorse if they were ever going to feel remorse. And so, for example, if you you give people back autobiographical memory, or if you increase their capacity for theory of mind, or increase their capacity for emotional empathy, so their ability to be sensitive to the moral properties of what they've done, then these sorts of things are more like tools that the person may end up using, isn't the right word, but that allow the person to come to feel remorse. It doesn't impose it on the person. It doesn't necessitate that they feel remorse. So we might draw an example with corrective glasses. So if we think about empathy as in part a sort of perceptual capacity, then if I put on my glasses, then I'll be able to see things more clearly. But this doesn't have any implications for what I'm going to think about what I see there, or whether I sort of focus on one place or another, whether I find the scene beautiful or so on or so forth. And in the same way, enhancing emotional empathy, for example, or even giving someone back an access to certain memories will allow them to have a more fine-grained appreciation of what's gone on. But it doesn't require then, it doesn't necessitate that they will go on to feel remorse. So I think that if remorse does end up being at the end of this chain of intervention, then there might still be an argument that it's morally valuable because it's not imposed on the agent, it's just facilitated.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it comes back to objections that are mounted against other forms of enhancement. So again, I recently had the conversation with Sven Nyholm about love enhancement, and that people think that if you use an enhancement to increase your attachment to somebody because maybe you're not feeling quite so romantic about your partner, that you've been together for so many years, the romance is dead, but you could just take this pill or use this neural stimulation device and it would kind of bump you up again. People might find that problematic insofar as it's inducing a response which is inauthentic in some sense. But what you're pointing out here is that there are ways in which the neurointervention can be used that don't induce, they don't necessitate a particular cognitive or emotional or affective response, but they build capacities for having that response.
Yes, exactly. And it goes back to the points that we discussed in right at the beginning about rational mediation and not bypassing cognitive deliberation. And so I think that that's a difference that pertains here, that the sort of idea of a remorse pill that would just induce remorse would bypass rational deliberation, whereas something that enabled you to get a better grasp of the nature of what you did, or be able to sort of appreciate the significance of what it means for someone else to suffer, this sort of change would, you know, give you kind of fuel on which to reflect, which, you know, by its nature is a rational process.
Yeah, and I like that idea because to me it helps to combat a common concern about all sorts of technological interventions and other kinds of changes in society, that they might distort or corrupt values and things that we hold dear, that they give us something other than what we really want. But as you're saying here, there are actually ways in which we can utilize the technology to get what we really want without the distorting or corrupting effect.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so I think we should leave it there and realize that this interview has gone on for quite some time and need to be respectful of your time. And I also need to leave and have a long drive ahead of me this evening. I'd like to thank you once again for joining me today, and it was really great to talk to you.
No, thank you. It's been really interesting.